Welcome to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast all about stories of safety leadership, presented by Dale Carnegie and the Board of Certified Safety Professionals.
Great opportunity to have this guest on to talk to us about a really dynamic part of keeping people safe and healthy in their work, but also to focus on the idea of collaboration and how important it is, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to have Lisa Brooks, who's a principal at Nexus HSE, with us today. Over the course of my career, I've learned a ton from Lisa. So those that are familiar with human and organizational performance and engaging the workforce, I think you're really in for a treat today. So welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Lisa, where are we talking to you from? Where are you located at?
I'm actually in Bettendorf, Iowa, which is part of the Quad Cities. It's right on the border of Iowa and Illinois, about 3 hours west of Chicago on the Mississippi River.
Yes, indeed. So we're always kind of curious, how did you ever get your life started into this idea of health and safety and these kind of things? Could you just kind of tell us how you got going with that?
Sure. Well, to be honest, I stumbled upon the field of ergonomics in grad school. So I studied mathematics and fitness in undergrad, and I wanted to find an applied field in mathematics. And I started grad school in sport biomechanics, which is a specialty under kinesiology. And I took occupational biomechanics my first semester, and that was offered over in the School of Engineering, and really stumbled upon the whole field of ergonomics and fell in love with it. And then did dual masters in industrial and operations engineering and kinesiology. So instead of, you know, sport biomechanics was all about optimizing athletic performance. So I just pivoted just a little bit and optimized industrial performance. And so, you know, at University of Michigan, the health and safety field is part of that within the industrial operations systems engineering. So ergonomics and safety were what I just stumbled upon and fell in love with. So
when you say you stumbled upon it, was it all of a sudden once it was being discussed and talked about that it's something that just lit up inside of you, that you saw the potential of need for it?
I'll be honest, it was twofold. One, it was the need for it, you know, optimizing industrial performance, and you can't optimize performance unless you first keep people safe. But the reality is, I also learned that in sport biomechanics, there was maybe 5 jobs in the country at the time. There's probably more. But that when I went over into the occupational biomechanics and ergonomics, human factors engineering, I really opened up a whole new world of possibility in terms of jobs and careers. But I still have passion for athletics and sports, but there's a lot of parallels and ways you can leverage that in the industrial setting. And there was a real need. And back in the day, I'm pretty old, but there weren't a whole lot of us doing ergonomics. And so it was really neat to be part of something new. There were consultants, but there were fewer folks actually working for companies as ergonomists. I would say within the automotive industry, there were ergonomists, but outside of that, not many, many companies had dedicated ergonomists. So it was really neat to be part of building the field in industry.
This idea of keeping people safe, keeping them well, I think we oftentimes look at accidents, injuries, but we forget to make sure that in the normal everyday work that people are doing, are we putting them into a situation that will not hurt them or limit them or affect them in a poor way physically? What's your thought on that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think with the ergonomics having a primary goal of preventing musculoskeletal disorders as it's linked to safety, I mean, it's about living people's best life, not only at work, but when they go home, allowing them to live their best life at home and not be too exhausted to play with their kids or grandkids or do the other activities that they love. So, you know, optimizing industrial performance means making sure that folks not only can be their best self at work, but be their best self at home as well.
I think what I hear you saying, Lisa, is as you're talking to us around engaging the individuals or at the worker level for those ergonomic designs and making sure that there's that constant influx of collaboration between, was that one of your kind of initial learnings as you moved into ergonomics, is about the importance of the input coming back to you as you design things?
Oh, absolutely. It's really interesting that, you know, I now am heavily involved in HOP, or human and organizational performance, and there's a real link to increasing the voice, the value of the workers, the voice of the workers. But back in the day, 30 some years ago, when we were starting ergonomics, you know, every health and safety professional did know that worker input was important. I think as an ergonomist, I understood it on another level, because when I was working to improve jobs, I went out in the field. I spent time learning from the workers, and wherever possible, and this was really fun, I got to try the jobs. And I made it a point that if they allowed me to, that I got to try the jobs. And I say that because some of the jobs were pretty physical. And, you know, I was, you know, a 24-year-old female out in there, and I was not really big. I was stronger than I looked because I was a college athlete, but I got to try some really interesting, fun jobs. And what I learned really, really early on is that there are insights about the job that cannot be gained any other way than doing the jobs. So I learned very, very quick that our workers have this, what I'll call operational intelligence, knowledge about work that no one else has. And I say that even as someone who was trained to watch, observe work, and to learn about work, there were things that just you didn't understand until you actually got to try it. So that lesson was reinforced really, really early on in my career. And I've really tried to, you know, promote that and be a mouthpiece for that, because not only does it help from the MSD prevention, but it helps in all aspects of health and safety, and even really doing, you know, finding better and more efficient ways to do work as a whole.
I had never heard that phrase, operational intelligence. And how often are a supervisor, a manager, or people even higher up in the organizations limited because they don't really know what that person is going through? Well, what difference would that make for us as leaders if we were willing to take the time to at least try to grasp and understand that? What difference could that bring?
You know, originally when we recognize that they have intelligence that we don't have, and safety has always said, you know, we need to get worker input. And for some, it was more like getting a check in the box. I've talked to the employees, I have gotten their input, but to really know down in your gut, in your heart, that if you don't get their input, you will not end up with the best, most optimal solution. So what's interesting is that a lot of times when leaders would engage workers, they thought they were doing it to build a relationship with the workers, or it was for the workers, when the reality, it's for the leaders. The leaders get the opportunity to learn about how real work gets done. And leaders' real job is to help the workers be as good as they possibly can be at getting their work done. Because when the workers are good at doing their jobs, the company makes more money. So really, it is both beneficial to the worker, because they're building this relationship, the leader and the worker, where the leader really spends time trying to get to understand how real work gets done, what barriers do they face, what challenges do they face. Then the leader is better at their job. The leader can be better at their job, especially when we understand that the leader's job is to build the systems that the workers operate in. And so if the leader is better at his job, then the company gets better. So it's a win-win-win from worker to leader to company.
I would be fearful, though, that many of us as leaders in organizations are really taking the time to do that because of all these other demands that we have on us. I'm not trying to be pessimistic, but what's your take? If you had to guess, what percentage of organizations and bosses and structures are taking time to grasp what you're talking about there, that operational intelligence?
I think a key is for the leader to understand how it benefits him and the company or her and the company, right? So a lot of times we say, I got to go do these field observations because I'm required to, because I'm told that I have to do this twice a month or once a month. And they do it because they're expected to. They don't do it because they truly see the value and understand that they're getting so much out of that and they will be better at their job. So once that connection is made, I think it'll be a lot easier and people will prioritize. And even if they're expected to go out and spend time in the field or on the manufacturing floor once a month, they may do it once a day, once a week, because they understand that it, the linkage between a better understanding of work means I'm better at my job, means the company's better. So by how we frame it and message it, that'll help us dramatically get to that next level.
Well, I'm going to turn it back to John to ask some more, but at some point we want to come back to that. For you to give us some input for somebody that says, that's listening to this right now, and they says, I've missed the boat. Where do they begin? What do they do? So we need to come back to that.
Yeah. Okay. And I think, you know, and I might be off on my Carnegie principles here, but I think that is arouse a need in another, right? Or a desire of another.
Yeah. Look at John. Look at John just jumping right in, because the third principle of Dale Carnegie's human relations principle is arouse in the other person an eager want.
That's right. And so as you move from I have to do this to I want to do this, that is that shift. And I think what I'm hearing and what Lisa's, I think, specifically talking about is kind of cooperation, communication, and collaboration. Yeah. And so in order for you to be successful in your performance at the company, you're going to need to shift into this mode.
Which yeah. there is one other principle there, Lisa, before we go ahead. And that is make the other person happy about doing the thing you suggest. That's a real leadership key. And we're going to help people to see a happy value there is to doing that. Wow, look at what you're doing for us.
And, you know, John said from have to want to. And then I think we realized total need to, like, I need to do this. Otherwise, I am not going to be as good as I possibly can be at all of the tasks and things I'm supposed to do. So from I have to, I want to, I need to.
So one of the things that I know you're really good at, Lisa, and I think for the listeners they could benefit from, is this concept of identifying stakeholders, getting that engagement as you're shifting from the have to the want to understanding the need and truncating that learning curve through collaboration with other groups, with other people, with other divisions, both internal to the company, external to the company. Can you talk a little bit about, in your career, has that been a benefit for you?
Oh, absolutely. So I have to say it became just readily apparent when I lost my collaboration community. So when I first started working for Alcoa, I was working with two other ergonomists. And so we were building the programs for Alcoa and we got to work together. And each of us had different connections, but every day we collaborated, right? And then my next job was with International Paper, and I was the corporate ergonomist. And I didn't have anyone else to really bounce my ideas off of. And I realized how lucky I was in my first job to have that opportunity. So I quickly realized how collaboration and teamwork and learning from others was so valuable. And so I quickly took advantage of the professional associations, of colleagues that I went to grad school with. There were other ergonomists in the paper industry. So I quickly created a community around ergonomics in that I could leverage in the paper industry. So absolutely, it's funny how you don't appreciate something nearly as much until it's gone. And then that lesson just was reinforced. And actually, my whole career, I have found opportunities to learn with and work with others. So collaboration, you look up at the definition and it talks about working with others, working collectively. But another synonym is teamwork. You know, you can work together on safety things without entering into areas that might not be advisable to share information.
Let's say that somebody is listening to this podcast and they're liking what they hear, and they're hearing that, and they realize this is good stuff. But suppose they are like the Lone Ranger. They don't have a staff with them. Or they have a staff, but nobody is really an expert on these things, these ergonomics. What could be some practical advice you'd give them of how to get started? Because they want to, but sometimes we don't always see how to do it. Could you give us a couple of tips?
Well, today I say there's huge opportunities that, quite honestly, I didn't have, 30 years ago. And that is, we have all of these digital tools that are available to us. There's LinkedIn communities on nearly every health and safety topic. So you have communities that you can build. And the neat thing about places like LinkedIn or community boards in the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society or the Applied Ergonomics Society is that you can get answers to questions by a broad group of people, but then you can reach out and begin to build individual relationships with these folks that you can connect outside of, say, those more larger boards and digital tools. So I would say that would be a quick, easy way to start, because that's where I found myself. I had unique expertise. The company hired me for that. And once I left Alcoa, I didn't have anyone else that I could have those same conversations with. So I think today's digital world has really has opportunities for young professionals and even senior professionals to connect in ways that we didn't have back then. You had to work a little harder back then.
Yes. Yes. So that certainly would be worth someone's while to explore. Is it even in the medical professionals in one's geographic area? Are there certain groups to reach out to in that, like at a hospital or a physical therapy clinic?
There's a lot of communities that are built also around. And, quite frankly, Nexus HSE, the company that I'm a principal at, we just built the company this year, and it was all about providing opportunities to create community and collaboration between folks who are working in industry so they can connect with other folks who are facing their same challenges, facing their same problems, and are at the same, say, relative level, meaning the challenges that are faced by someone at the facility level may be different than the challenges that someone is facing with rolling out a program at a business or a corporate level. So finding community that also understands where you are in your organization and the challenges you face, it can be important. I say that, but at the same time, I would make sure that people recognize that there's opportunity to learn from everyone at different levels of the organization, at different expertise, at different places on their journey. That's one of the things that I've learned over and over again is that, okay, I may be, 5 years into my journey on a particular topic. Someone else is just starting. There are many things I can learn from that person just starting. So you don't have to only learn from folks who are either equal or more mature than you in terms of a particular discipline. There are opportunities to learn from people wherever they are on their journey, whether it's a hop journey in ergonomics, you know, safety management systems, that, you know, that we have to be open-minded and humble about the opportunity to learn from all different sources.
Yeah, and I would just say, I mean, those groups, Merle, for me, have been tremendously beneficial because it allows a fast forwarding of your progress, because you get insight into things that you might not be aware of. And as you're looking, a lot of folks listening to the podcast, if you are that Lone Ranger, if you are that facility specialist, you can almost think about it as like a support group. And so not only are you learning, but then you can also commiserate around maybe some of your challenges. And it might crack open the door to something you hadn't thought about before. And they said, yeah, I used to be sitting in that seat and I tried this. And so that was effective for us. Have you tried it? Is it something that you can move forward in? So that spirit of sharing, and you know, I wrote down here is that, you know, time is not infinite. So when you say yes to something, you say no to something else. And as you're looking at that, are you saying yes to your professional development, even if you are that Lone Ranger?
And I think that's the key thing that we need to keep in mind. And it's an emphasis we've been saying here. Not to be content, to be grateful for what you know, but not to be content with it. To say, wait a minute, this lady named Lisa may have opened up a whole new way of thought that, again, Lisa, as you said, that we can help our employees so that they are better in work and in personal life, but that comes back with dividends for us as a company and organization in retention, in production, in so many different ways. So we would encourage everybody, don't be stale. Be willing to say, wait a minute, this might be something worth exploring, and to take those steps to do that.
And I think, Lisa, if you can talk a little bit about to us, you know, being honest about where you're at, and what does that look like for a health and safety professional, and what are some self-awareness tools in addition to, as you identify that, how do you go and improve? What are those resources that are available?
Humble inquiry and being humble is really, really important. And what that means is acknowledging that you don't know everything and that that's okay. And what's, I think, as leaders over the years, we have been rewarded by knowing the answer, right? By knowing things and getting things done and fast decisions. And we're now saying, you know, you need to be courageous. And it does take courage to admit that you don't know everything. And recognizing that others have knowledge that you can learn from. And it's not a matter of where you are in the organization. It's a matter of exposure. So being open to learning from every discipline, from every level of the organization. So I want to share a quote. I love this quote. It's by a gentleman by the name of Eric Hoffer, and it's called, "In a World of Change," which I think that we would all agree that we're in a world of change. "In a world of change, the learners shall inherit the earth, while the learned," or I like to say the know-it-alls, "shall find themselves perfectly suited for a world that no longer exists." So if you're not willing to learn, you're going to quickly find yourself irrelevant, right? So I love that, you know, I call myself a lifelong learner, constantly learning. And even from the same people in the same class, I've taken some classes 4 and 5, 10 times, heard the same speaker speak the same message. And every time I leave with something new, there's always an opportunity to learn.
First of all, Carnegie said, be a good listener. Encourage the other person to talk about themselves. And when we heard you say earlier about how you would go to employees and ask them to describe their work and what goes on, that's the idea of encourage them to talk so that we can hear about them and their perspective. And then the other one, Lisa, as we think about being humble is principle number 12, and that is, if you are wrong, admit it quickly and emphatically. And that's the spirit of humility that says, let's just lay the cards on the table here. I could do better. I could listen better. I haven't been doing that. And what a difference that would make for us as leaders, certainly in this area, but in all areas combined.
And it takes courage to admit that you were wrong.
Yes.
It takes courage to admit that you don't know the answer. And again, I think we've conditioned our leaders that that's not a place that they're supposed to be. So we, you know, it's incumbent upon us to lead by example, to say that it's okay to say I was wrong. And one of the things that I learned in my career is that you may be doing the best that you can possibly do with the knowledge you have at that moment in time. But as we learn more, we find that, oh, now I know something different, that is no longer the best case. And to acknowledge that, yes, I did, you know, I'll use an example. Back belts. Back in the day, everyone and their brother were using back belts. And then the recognition was back belts actually may encourage injuries depending upon how they're used. So I think the best managers will share that. We'll say we now know new information and we do not recommend using back belts. It will not help prevent back injuries, right? I was really funny. I worked with a company and at the time the manager did not want to say they were wrong. Like for them to say that, to share that we now have new data science research, he felt like he was saying he was wrong and he didn't want to admit it. So you know what he did? He provided pink back belts. And this was a male-dominated field. And guess what? The guys didn't want to wear pink back belts. So he did it another way because he didn't have the courage to say, I was wrong before, not because I did anything wrong, but now I know different and more information.
Well, I think it's salmon colored now. I think we use salmon. I don't know. And so
you moderated.
Yeah, that's right. So it goes to a point around adaptability, I think, is really what you're talking about, and being willing and open to having the courage to be adaptable. So Lisa, for those that are listening and they say, okay, I get what you're saying and I want to go down that path. I mean, what are some of the key steps that an individual can take in really starting to expand their learning, both actively seeking it out and you know, cultivating their own skill set? What would be your advice to somebody that's looking to go on that learning journey?
So good questions. I would first build a community that of others that also want to learn. Search out those communities that are about collaboration, about learning. And I would also see if you're able to identify a mentor. That's someone that can keep you honest. You know, for me, someone that says, Lisa, you're talking too much. Let other people talk. You know, that's that little voice in your ear that you can get honest feedback from on where you are in your approaches and how you come across. Because you mentioned, Merle, you mentioned the EQ, emotional intelligence or quotient. And not everyone is great at perceiving how they come across to others. So, and I find for me personally, when I get excited about something, I get really passionate about something, I can just blow past people and not really understand how I'm coming across. For me, it's passion. For it comes across as others as almost, you know, just rolling on over other people's. And that's not my intent. It's just to express excitement. So having those people, whether it's a mentor that is inside your company, whether it is a trusted employee that might be at a level in your organization that's even lower than you, because they can help you understand how you're perceived across the organization, and even someone outside your organization that will truly be honest with you on where you are and where your opportunities are for learning, for listening, for engaging, for exhibiting this humble inquiry. And going back to that, you know, humble inquiry is all about asking questions in a fashion that communicates that A, you really are interested in the other person's response, and B, you don't think you already know everything or know the answer.
That spirit that you're displaying, the spirit of curiosity, is one that should be able to help all of us. I mean, this is a great lesson for us today, that if we kind of get full of ourselves and in our own little world and we feel like, I got this down and look at what I know, but the spirit and the hunger of curiosity that says, wait a minute, what's this, the viewpoint and the perspective of others? And I have a quote I'm going to share with you. It's not a Carnegie quote. And then I'm going to ask you to respond on it.
Okay.
The quote is, we see things not as they are. We see things as we are. In other words, we tend to have a lens that we look at situations in. Lenses that are based on our experiences and our good things and bad things. How important is it for us to be willing to let the lens of somebody else, of how they see things, to help us?
It's huge. You know, it's the whole, the old adage, walk a mile in your shoes. So when I talk about in human and organizational performance, they have this whole black line, blue line concept. And the black line is how the leaders and managers and planners think work can be done. The blue line is how it actually gets done. So when we're trying to understand the blue line, we have to make sure that we're putting ourselves in the shoes of the worker, understanding their context, because they don't make the blue line because they're lazy or complacent. They're creating this blue line because they have to in order to get the work done. They have to, given the constraints and resources and challenges and expectations operating on them in that moment. But if we look at it and look at the black line, we're seeing the context of leaders. So we have to put ourselves in the mindset of the worker, walk a mile in their shoes in order to really understand the necessity for that blue line, in order to feel and experience the challenges and the barriers and the reasoning for that, that blue line was necessary in order to get work done.
So you're saying that those lines don't overlap perfectly? I'm kidding, Lisa. And so
they overlap.
That's
right. But they are not perfectly aligned. Yeah. And here's the thing, is that some people say, well, if we wrote them, you know, in partnership with the employees, that we could, you know, have them be almost magically aligned. And the truth is they will never, ever be aligned, because we can't know all the variables that are, that occur in work, right? And it, the truth is we wouldn't want to have procedures that contain every possible variable that that workers would experience, because our guidance would be so huge and cumbersome, it would be rendered useless, right? So we actually rely on the operational intelligence of our workers to successfully navigate this blue line to get work done successfully. And when we say successfully, we mean the right productivity, the right quality, the right, and doing it all safely, right?
So this truth is so important. It goes along with Carnegie's principle, like you stated another way, but the principle is try honestly to see things from the other person's point of view. So just so we get some clarity from you to help us with your experience, help us know, us as listeners, what is a practical way? How do you see where you've done it, or you've seen other people do it successfully, where they are able to see things from their point of view, from the point of view of the frontline people, the point of view. Just help us see what that looks like, so we don't just have it in theory, but we see it practically in action. Could you help us on some of those?
So there's good news and bad news.
Okay.
The bad news is we can never fully see work from the worker's perspective because there are things that only can be felt or learned from by doing work. But at the same time, recognizing that there's operational intelligence that the workers have that no one else has, we can get better at muting the internal responses like, what in the world was he or she thinking? All of those phrases that come into our minds that judge or condemn workers for making mistakes or for not being on the black line. Once you have over time, several examples where you withhold your judgment, you may have it in your brain, but you don't let it eke out of your body, out of your mouth and your actions in any way. And you take the time to learn. There are things you learn, you have, you're like, oh, I get it. And there's these aha moments. Then that helps the next time that you don't jump to conclusions. So it ends up muting more and more and more those internal voices that say, how in the blanky blank did that person do that? Or I know I wouldn't make that choice. But the reality is, because we have different perspectives, because we come into it with a different knowledge and different information, we cannot perfectly put ourselves in their shoes. But it's important for us to recognize that we can get closer and that it takes deliberate effort for us to try. And that we must try, especially when something bad happens, because it's so easy to jump to blame and condemn the employee. We have to pause, take the time to learn before we determine what actions are necessary. And in that learning, there's so many times where you go, holy crap, we're lucky that something worse didn't happen, right? So
now this is so real and so practical. Could you think of an example where you've seen where somebody has put into practice what you just talked about? And they won't understand everything of the person, but they're trying to tap in to understand that operational perspective.
One facility that I worked with, they had a lockout tagout event. Now, there was no one hurt, but there was a reported lockout tagout violation where a maintenance worker did not properly lock out a machine before he started working on it. And the employee was actually given 3 days off, no pay, because they had these golden rules that said, if you violate any of these high risk work procedures, automatic response, discipline. And it was funny because it was a facility that was probably a year into their hop journey. And the plant manager had made a commitment that they would never discipline without first taking the time to learn. And the employees held his feet to the fire and said, you let this guy, you know, he's 3 days off and you didn't take the time to learn about what happened. And in the end, they brought him back, made him whole, and they took the time to learn. And what they discovered is that production employees were required to lock out the machine before they ever entered into that particular area where this maintenance guy was doing work. This guy, because he was a maintenance worker, had been trained that he could partially lock out and enter in that work area because he was doing a different type of task. And in fact, there are some maintenance tasks that has to be partially energized in order to do the work, to finish the work. So in this case, the plant manager took the time, brought him back whole. They discovered that they did have these two different environments. They operated differently, and they actually developed more detailed guidance of when full lockout was necessary, when partial, who could do it, and they informed the other party. So production workers understood more about maintenance and what they were allowed to do, and then the maintenance knew what the expectations were for production. But it took the time to ask questions and to really understand the worker, because he was very confused. He's like, I was trained to do this. Why did I get let go or 3 days off? And of course, you're trying to figure out what happened, and he's not even there to be part of the conversation. So that's a great example, in that sometimes we jump to conclusions. We assume that lockout tagout is fully required for everyone, and then we realize there's nuances in our operations that as leaders, we don't always know about.
So to summarize that, what I believe heard you say was, we do not want to be quick to condemn, criticize. We want to go with the spirit of, help me understand what's happened here and hear things out so we can understand better.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the keys to doing that is to stay away from the word why.
Tell us more.
When you use the word why, you often end with a person, whether it's an employee or a supervisor or a manager. When you change your thinking around what and how, you end up finding systems. Now, there will people that have debated me in the past and said, well, I can ask why questions and get to systems. And you can, but it takes a lot more deliberate effort. When you use what and you use how, it more naturally goes away from individuals and towards systems. So it helps you get more meaningful information in which you can make learn and improve. Really, because the goal of evaluating all events is to learn and improve, right? That's what we want to do, learn and improve, not only in that specific narrow scenario, but our entire operation.
So what would you say to some of the folks that are listening thinking, I hear you, Lisa, and it all makes sense, but man, that takes a lot of extra time. I don't know if I had the time to do that. How could you tell them that you don't have the time not to?
You've never heard that before, have you? Where somebody said, we don't have time?
So it's funny you say that, because that certainly is a concern. And one time when we were working with the facility and we were doing training on HOP fundamentals and learning teams, and the quality manager was so upset. He was just livid. He came in the second, because we did 4 hours on one day and 4 hours the second day. And the next morning, he was just extremely upset, because his understanding was this was going to take so much more time, put all kinds of additional expectations on him, because this particular plant, an event was an event, whether it was a quality excursion or a safety excursion, an event was an event. And so we had to work through and to say this process, this thinking doesn't necessarily take more time. Now, sometimes it might. We're not going to promise you that it never will, but you're getting and exposing opportunities for improvement so much more efficiently. So if your goal is to learn and improve your systems, you're exposing where you have opportunities to improve your systems. And so in the end, you're preventing more effectively all kinds of future negative outcomes. I'll share another story. One of the companies I worked with, they had a particular facility that was by far the worst in terms of their safety performance, by every measure. You know, if you looked at their safety management system, if you looked at their injury rates, if you looked at their most serious injuries, any way you looked at their safety performance, they were one of the worst in the company. And the plant manager was a little hesitant to dedicate time, because they just had so many problems. As you guys who have been in health and safety understand, if a plant has a lot of health and safety issues, they likely have a lot of operational issues as well, right? So he was a little hesitant to allow the time for this learning team activity. And one of the things when you start out with learning teams is you can have someone in a leadership position kick it off, but they can't be in the room, because it kind of changes the whole environment. It colors what people are willing to say. So he left and then came back at the end of the first session, and then came back at the end of the second session, and he left and he goes, oh my goodness. He goes, you know, before we always did corrective actions. We were required to do corrective actions by corporate. now I actually feel confident that our corrective actions that we are implementing are actually going to make a difference. Like they're actually going to make our process better. And that's what taking the time to learn does. It makes sure that what you're doing will actually make things better. Because sometimes it doesn't make things better, but it doesn't make it worse. Sometimes it makes things worse. But by giving, taking the time to learn and giving a voice to the workers, then you can be confident that what you're doing is making your systems better.
What would you say in simple terms that you would encourage folks to take action on? What would, if they're going to put one action in within the next 2 weeks, what's the action you would encourage them to do?
Step one would be dedicate time to learning from the real work, where the real work gets done. Recognize that you workers have this unique operational intelligence and build in time, build in a regular rhythm where you can learn for them. And make sure that when you're learning from them, they know that's the objective of why you're out there, right? Frame the conversations, frame the reason you're out there, share with the workers that we appreciate everything you're doing. We know you face challenges that we don't know anything about. We know you're master problem solvers, and I would love for you to share some of that information with me today. And just let them go and share and take the time to learn from your workers.
And Lisa, thank you very much for what you've given us today. You have just reminded us of the deep resource that we have from those frontline workers that we've sometimes taken for granted and overlooked. But the depth and the help that we really need, there's a great deal of that that lies there within them, and we're wise to tap into it. So thank you very much for coming and being a part with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This was a lot of fun. And John promised me it would go faster than I could imagine. And he was right.
Wow, Merle, that was a lot to take in. And I think it gives us a lens that maybe we don't always approach it with. And you know, one of my key takeaways is, although it seems common sense, we don't always approach it as common sense. The work getting done at a level, where is that operational intelligence in how you design what you do every day? And so that's a big takeaway for me.
Often overlooked and yet necessary. Another real takeaway that I had was, are we going to invest the time and put the time into it? Because though we say we don't have time, in reality, John, it's just when we want to spend the time. We can either do it now or put it off, but somehow we're going to pay. You either pay it now or you pay it later. You just decide when you want to pay the price. So if you do it up front, you can avoid some of those wasteful times later on. So thank you, Lisa, for the good insights today.
If you say yes to something, you're saying no to something else.
Exactly right.
Thanks for listening to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast produced in partnership by Dale Carnegie and BCSP, with your host, Dale Carnegie Master Trainer Merle Heckman, and John Fisher, Director of Environmental Strategy and Corporate EHS at Duke Energy Corporation. Executive produced by Joel Bergai, directed by Giachi Liu, edited by Jared Grio and Kyla Anderson. Editorial support from Brandon Mohaupt. Social media support from Braylon Morgan. Consulting producers are Colin Brown and Mark Sullivan. To have new episodes delivered directly to you, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you'd like to share your story of a safety leadership challenge you faced, email us at info@mybigsafetychallenge.com. See you next time.